Thank you for attending the 2020 Sunstone Digital Symposium, Session 133, titled Transforming Our Grief-Filled Mormon Experiences into Gratitude. The audio from this session will be available for purchase at sunstone.org after the symposium. The video recording of this session will be available in the Whova app for approximately 3 months, beginning at the end of August 2020. If time permits, we will have a Q&A. So please type your questions into the Whova app to be addressed during the Q&A session. At Sunstone, we are making it a goal to build a community that allows many ways for people to express their faith. Our tagline is, "There's more than one way to Mormon." We invite you to help us build a community where all paths are given space to be better understood. Please support us in our mission by making a donation and subscribing at sunstone.org. About this presentation. Sometimes the difference between feeling grief or gratitude about our Mormon experience is our perspective. How do we perceive the meanings and consequences of our faith's journey? How do we view our relationships with various Mormons in our lives? In this session, we will draw from social psychology to identify some ways we can subtly change our perceptions of other Mormons and our own relationship to Mormonism, whatever that might be, to help gratitude about our experiences come more easily. Our experiences as Mormons are rare and unique, and they are something that we can be grateful for, even in the face of grief. I'll take a second to introduce you to our speaker before we begin. Peter Levitt is a social psychologist and assistant professor of psychology at Indiana State University. He teaches about and studies cultural differences, intercultural communication, civil discourse, diversity, and social class. I'll now give the floor to our presenter.
Hello, everybody. I am so grateful to be here and so grateful that you're all joining me. While I introduce myself, I'm going to share my screen with you, and I would like you to, if you have a computer or smartphone available, quickly answer this question for me. You just go to the menti.com, enter that code, and then you can enter a quick response. Just to help me get a sense of who I've got in the room with me, so that hopefully I can tailor my message appropriately. The introduction of me is great. I'm a social psychologist at Indiana State University, and I study culture and diversity and intercultural communication. And my Mormon journey is that I was raised Mormon in Canada, moved around quite a bit, lived in Southern Alberta a bit, which is very Mormon. Faith crisis during Proposition 8 in California. Ended up leaving the church, now consider myself an ex-Mormon. And this is part of my, that's the short, very short version of my narrative, but it gives you a little bit of a sense of where I'm coming from. And all right, I'm getting a couple of responses in there on the menti.com, which is great. All right, a few post-Mormons, fundamental Mormon. I love this. This is part of what I love about Sunstone is the exposure to so many different types of Mormons. And I really appreciate you all being here and sharing yourselves with me in this way. So I've had a bit of a chance to do that. I'm going to move on to the main presentation now. So like the session says, I'll be talking about transforming our grief-filled Mormon experiences into gratitude. Gonna start by just acknowledging that sometimes our Mormon experiences lead us to experience grief. There are lots of things that can happen in our faith journeys that lead us to experience loss, lead us to experience a sense of grief. And sometimes this can be very intense grief. It can be difficult to find reasons to be grateful for the experiences that we have. I know personally, it's often very difficult for me not to get preoccupied with the things that I feel I've lost and I can't get back, to not get preoccupied with resentment over how I think my journey prevented me from experiencing things or doing things. Sometimes it's very hard to see past that and see reasons for gratitude, but I strongly believe that reasons for gratitude coexist with those reasons for our grief. And I think that our perspective on our Mormon experiences can make a big difference in how we feel and experience this stuff. Some of you may have heard the, it's common in kind of ex-Mormon and ex-religious circles, the saying, what's unique about Mormons isn't good, and what's good about Mormons isn't unique. And I have to say, I strongly disagree. I think that our perspective makes that, our perspective is what makes that feel true or false. And I think that we can change our perspective so that we can notice more about what's both unique and good about our Mormon experiences, even when those same experiences or similar concurrent experiences are causing us grief. Our perspective really, really matters for a lot of reasons, but in particular, when it comes to something like a faith experience, a faith journey, a faith crisis, the way that we are looking at things, our vantage point, really dramatically affects how we're interpreting what happens, how we explain what happens, and how we feel as a result. Often our perspective is not just about our vantage point, but a disagreement about that vantage point, a disagreement about what is reality, what is happening, is often a source of the grief as well that we experience. So an ability to appreciate these differences in perspectives is part of what I think can help us handle these experiences better. I also think that sometimes our vantage point, the way that we experience our Mormon life and the way that we look out at the world, sometimes causes us to overlook the valuable things about where we're at, the things that are good and useful and the things that other people could find good and useful. But because we're looking outside of ourselves, it's sometimes hard to see those things. So in this talk, I want to talk about a few things and draw from social psychology to make these points. I want to share some ideas that I have drawn from social psychology for how we can explain our experiences, our Mormon experiences, our faith journey experiences, our faith crisis experiences in more positive and productive terms. I'll be referring to attribution theory and attribution biases and social identity processes to make these points. And I also want to discuss some ideas for finding overlooked sources of value and gratitude in our Mormon experiences. And I think that these come in two main things, but there's lots more that I'm happy to talk about. But I think that our experiences gave us the potential for increased empathy and compassion for others in general, and especially for those with unique belief systems and belief systems different than our own. I also think that the diverse social networks that so often come out of our Mormon experiences are a true gift that we often overlook, that I don't think we often fully appreciate the value of the diverse social networks that we develop as part of our Mormon experiences. And so I want to talk about those. I do want to mention a few caveats as we go through this. I'm not a therapist, so my discussion of grief is not rooted in therapy. It's not meant to be therapeutic. I strongly encourage you to visit with and attend some of the other talks given by some great therapists. I know that there's at least one attendee here who has helped me in the past in a therapeutic role deal with some of my challenges. And so there's so many great resources for therapeutic stuff. I'm not the therapist, but I am happy to talk about all of this stuff and perspective taking and that kind of thing. I want to make it clear that the point of this is not that as a result of this talk, you're going to not feel grief anymore and you'll never feel grief again. Don't want to give that impression. That's not what's going to happen. Your grief is there. It's real. It's part of you. You will feel grief again in the future. It's just part of human life. But I do think that these suggestions that I offer can be subtle changes to the way that we interpret our grief, the way that it affects us, and the way that we interpret future events, future losses that might lead us to grieve. I also want to make clear that the benefits of what I share are not inevitable. So for me, I see the value in this, but it's also clear that it's not as simple as just me saying that these are good and therefore you will benefit from them. Some effort is required, and it absolutely interacts with your own experiences, your unique story and your own unique challenges, which brings me to my last caveat that my perspective might not capture your experiences very well. That because of aspects of my identity, that I'm a straight white man, that mainstream Mormonism worked pretty well for me in ways that it probably didn't work for other people who are experiencing Mormonism in whatever way they are. The fact that I grew up in Canada, the fact that I moved around a lot, means that my experience is different than somebody who has lived in Utah their whole life, for example. So my perspective might not capture your experiences perfectly well, but what I hope is that you'll identify the common themes, the useful tools at the heart of what I'm talking about that you can apply to your situation, whatever it is. Let's start by, how can we explain our experiences better? This is a very broad framing of this question, but we're going to attack it by talking about attribution theory, which is a very common theory in social psychology, one of the basic kind of ideas in social psychology. The idea is that we as humans, as social beings, we want to understand why people behave the way they do, why people are doing what they're doing. So we have a natural tendency to attribute other people's behavior and our own behavior to certain things. So, and to simplify things, we usually consider these two types of information: internal causes of behavior and external causes of behavior. So we look at somebody behaving a certain way, and you can think about whatever Mormons are relevant in your life, whatever kind of Mormon people might be involved in your grief experiences or loss experiences. We see them behave, and we consider, what are the internal causes for this, potential internal causes for this? What are the potential external causes for this? We weigh their likelihood, and we settle on some kind of explanation that this person did this thing that hurt me because they are a bad person who wants to hurt others. Or this person did this thing that hurt me because they were distracted and weren't paying attention to what they were doing, which would be a kind of an external cause, right? So often it's some combination of these things, but at its core, this is a tendency that we all have. It's a very strong innate psychological tendency. We want to be able to explain why people are doing what they're doing. Connected to the research on this stuff is that, especially when we're talking about our own behavior and our own outcomes, the most productive way to attribute our own behavior, which isn't to say that it's always just or fair that this would be the way to go, but that the most productive attribution is to say that something, that our outcomes are a result of internal causes, it's something about me, and that that's changeable, it's not permanent. I'm happy to discuss the nuances of that because I know it's way more complicated, but I think it's useful to think about this in part because of the internal causes are what we have control over. And if we believe that the things inside us are changeable, then it means that whatever's going on, whatever outcomes were happening to us, they're not permanent, they're not inevitable, we can do something about it. So that's why I say productive, and not the same as saying that the situation you're in is fair or just. Now, understanding that we have this strong tendency to want to explain behavior, others' behavior, our own behavior, it's not so simple as just we come up with accurate explanations all the time. There are lots of ways in which our thinking, our explaining is biased. One simple way that this happens is what's called the fundamental attribution error. We overestimate internal causes of others' behavior, and we underestimate external causes. So what I mean by this is that when we see somebody else engaging in a behavior, we're likely to exaggerate how much they're doing that because of the kind of person that they are. And we're likely to kind of underestimate potential external causes for that behavior. So to connect this to our discussion of kind of grief and gratitude in Mormonism, in our Mormon experiences, when we're looking at somebody else's behavior that has caused us grief in some way or caused us harm, it's likely that we are overestimating the degree to which that person's behavior is due to the kind of person that they are, and we're underestimating the degree to which that person's behavior could be explained by external factors. And I want to be clear when I'm saying this. What I'm saying here is not that I'm not trying to absolve anybody of behavior that might have hurt you or others. But what I am saying is that we're probably slightly misjudging, and probably in a more bad way, what caused that behavior. Another way that our attributions, our explanations for behavior can be biased is the self-serving bias. We're more likely to use external causes to explain our own outcomes, especially when those outcomes are bad. Part of this is just where our attention is focused, right? So when things happen to us, when we experience things, our attention is focused outward, not inward. And so we're more likely to notice external causes, potential external reasons why things happened the way they did, and we're less likely to notice internal factors. Again, this isn't, I want to be very careful here. I'm not suggesting that we take a victim blaming kind of perspective on this, but I am, what I am saying is, again, this subtle shift in this recognition that the way that we're explaining what happens might not always be the most objectively accurate explanation for how things happen. And I think an appreciation of that can help us deal more productively with the experiences that we have, whatever they are. And one other thing I wanted to mention is this tendency for a belief in a just world to influence the way that we explain things. And so what a belief in a just world refers to is simply that a person believes that the world is a fair place, a just place where good things happen to good people, bad things happen to bad people. And this is a common belief among religious people, and especially among Mormons. I was taught very explicitly that this is the case, that God has a plan for us, that God doesn't give us more suffering than we can handle, and et cetera, et cetera. And so this is a very common belief, a very common mindset. But what that means is that when things happen to us, we're likely to explain these outcomes, explain other people's behavior in a way that helps us keep believing that the world is a just and fair place. So when bad things happen to us, especially at the hands of other Mormons, for example, it's easier for us to maintain this belief that the world is just and fair if we believe that the person who harmed us is a uniquely bad individual, that they're kind of messing up the plan, they're circumventing God's will, or that they're testing you with this experience or something like that. So again, the point is that this is the kind of thing that can distort our explanations for what's happening to us. And I think understanding that and appreciating that, applying it to our own reflections about what happens to us, can be a useful way of managing the emotional experiences that we have. The other thing I wanted to mention about how we explain our behaviors is to talk about the importance of social identity. So in social psychology, this generally refers to the parts of our self-concepts or understanding of who we are that come from our social groups. So if you were to respond to this phrase I've got on the screen here, I am blank, a whole bunch of times, the responses that you give, the way you fill in that blank, would probably include a bunch of individual characteristics. So for me, it'd be like, I am tall, I am smart, those kinds of things. But there's also a lot of group identities. I am an ex-Mormon, I am Canadian, I am a brother. All of these social groups that I fill in the blank with are my social identities. And these are very, very important for us. These are sources of self-esteem and meaning. So the groups we belong to help us feel like we are worth something, that we have meaning and purpose, that we belong to something meaningful. And we naturally, very naturally, form social identities, and we very naturally stick very closely to the groups that we belong to because of how important they are for our self-esteem and meaning. They shape in very fundamental ways how we think about ourselves and others. And this is something that I think is overlooked when we're trying to explain what's happening to us and why, and making sense of our experiences. So I wanted to talk quickly through a few classic studies in social psychology that help us understand how fundamental this is and how impactful the social identity is when we're trying to make sense of our experiences. So one classic study, some young men came into a laboratory experiment setting, and they were asked to rate a series of paintings by the painters Klee and Kandinsky. And after they finished making these ratings, they were told arbitrarily that based on their ratings of the paintings, they were either a Klee person or a Kandinsky person. And then they were asked some follow-up questions about how they felt about other Klee people, other the Kandinsky people, and so on and so forth. And what the results found was that based on this mere distinction alone of whether or not your arbitrary classification as a Klee person or Kandinsky person made you prefer other people who were like you. So if you're a Klee person, you preferred other Klee people, you'd more likely to be generous to them, and you would be more likely to dislike and be less generous to Kandinsky people. So this is an illustration of how it doesn't take much to activate these powers of social identity, for us to want to latch onto a group, to feel good about ourselves, and to kind of put down other groups or treat other groups differently as a way to enhance our own group. In a more powerful real world demonstration of how this plays out is the classic classroom demonstration of Jane Elliott. Some of you may have come across this in your own classes at some point or another, but in this demonstration, she divides her classroom of white students into two groups, blue eyes and brown eyes, and it just arbitrarily assigns one of those groups to wear these collars. And they're told, the ones wearing the collars are told that they're not as good as the other students. And they go about their daily activities in the classroom. And it's striking how easily this simple distinction, blue eyes, brown eyes, and wearing that collar, can lead to differences in how the students think about themselves, differences in how the students treat each other, how they perform in their academic work, and so on. And so this is a more impactful example of how social identity, even seemingly arbitrary group memberships, can dramatically shape our thoughts and behavior. And the connection to our Mormon experiences for this is that our Mormon identity is something that is incredibly central to who we are. For a lot of us, for me it was. It was incredibly central to who I was. It was a main part of my identity. It was something from which I derived a lot of self-esteem, a lot of meaning. And it absolutely shaped my thoughts and behavior. It shaped the way that I thought about myself, and it shaped the way that I thought about others. And it did this in ways that I wasn't aware of. It meant that I was exaggerating my own goodness and the goodness of my Mormon group, and I was exaggerating the badness of non-Mormons and other groups, right? And I did this without any conscious awareness of doing this. And I think that when we're trying to make sense of our Mormon experiences, our faith journey, our faith crisis, that this process is still in effect. And we don't often grant others the kind of the charity of understanding how powerfully motivating their social identity is for whatever behavior they're engaging in, for whatever the Mormons around us we see are doing, that they are behaving in ways that allow them to maintain a close connection to that Mormon community and continue to derive self-esteem and meaning from belonging to that community. And I think that that's often a much better explanation than simply this person is a bad person, or this person was trying to hurt me, or whatever. So this is I think understanding how powerfully social identity shapes our thoughts and behavior can help us make a little bit more sense of why our experiences sometimes happen the way that they do. And also the sense of loss and grief that we feel when we lose that community. For me, I had a hard time finding, and I would say I'm still in search of, a community that granted me quite the same kind of sense of worth and meaning that my Mormon community gave me. As an ex-Mormon, it's a little bit unmooring to not have that community. I miss that. It is a serious source of loss and grief for me. And I think understanding that and acknowledging that is an important part of me managing my experiences as an ex-Mormon. To just highlight one other aspect of the power of social identity, I want to talk about research on ostracism and rejection. So what I've got on the screen here is a research method used to study rejection. And it helps illustrate how strongly motivated we are to belong. In this research method, you got the two cartoon figures and you got the participant. So the participant is sitting at a computer. They're told that hand is their hand and they're supposed to play pass with these cartoon figures, throwing the ball between each other. Early on in the experiment, the ball gets passed back and forth between everybody equally. Later in the experiment, the two cartoon figures start throwing the ball back and forth between the two of them and excluding the participant. And this alone is enough to induce feelings of rejection in a person. So being excluded by two cartoon figures on a computer screen in this way is enough to induce feelings of rejection, right? So not necessarily intense feelings of rejection, but feelings of rejection. And to me, this highlights how powerful our motives to belong to meaningful social groups are. Like, we want to belong to this group of cartoon figures on the computer screen. How much more do we want to belong to this Mormon community that gives us identity and purpose and meaning and worth? And how much will we do to defend that and to prevent losing that? And I think contextualizing other people's behavior more in that can help us make sense of why people sometimes do things that are hurtful, things that don't make sense. And another thing that I think we can derive from this is, especially for those of us who have been rejected, who have been ostracized in some way, we know how crappy that feels. And we, for me at least, it's very motivating to me not to reject others, to help other people avoid that same sense of rejection. It helps me form community with others who have been rejected. And I think that's another important kind of hidden piece of value that we can derive from our experiences, is that experience of rejection can make us more sensitive to and compassionate towards those who are avoiding rejection or those who have been rejected. So a quick summary of this section: we explain things in ways that help us feel better about ourselves and the groups we belong to. And what this means is that we will often exaggerate the bad in others and exaggerate the good in ourselves. And this will sometimes make it difficult to maintain positive or even neutral connection with other people in our lives, with other communities that in our lives, and so on. Again, the point is, I want to make it very clear that my suggestion to rethink this stuff is not so that other people can dodge responsibility for harming you or hurting others or whatever, but it's to rethink the way we explain the motives of other people, why people are doing what they're doing, in ways that I think are more compassionate, that can help us manage our own experiences better and help other people manage their experiences a little bit better. So I'm just periodically checking the Whova app. I keep getting notifications, want to make sure that that I'm addressing things as I go if I can. So now I want to talk about some overlooked sources of value and gratitude in our Mormon experiences. And so this is something that is really important to me. I see so often in people who've experienced a faith crisis or doubt or rejection, a real difficulty to see any value in where they've come from. And I understand, again, this is the limits of my perspective, my experiences, while I've experienced grief and loss, not the same as other people's. And so I totally get that there are different levels of how we go through this and how easy it is to identify sources of value and gratitude. But I think there are some things that we overlook too easily. So one thing I want to talk about is our potential for increased empathy. Now, for this, I want to talk about theory of mind, which is a psychological idea, basically refers to our human ability to understand that the way that we see the world is not necessarily the way that others see the world, in a very literal and basic sense. And so you can see this in the image I've got on the screen there. This is the Sally Ann test, is what it's called. This is Sally, this is Ann, Sally has a ball. She puts it in her basket. Sally goes out for a walk and takes the ball out of the basket and then puts the ball in the box. Now Sally comes back. She wants to play with the ball. Where will Sally look for the ball? Now, we looking at this, we understand that Sally will look for the ball where she put it. She put it in the basket, so that's the first place she's going to look. But very young children, and I think research on autism shows that autistic people have trouble with this as well. They will often, so very young children especially, fail to realize that Sally doesn't see things as they do. So very young children will say, oh, Sally's going to look for the ball in the box, because they assume that Sally has the same, Sally shares their mind, right? But in reality, Sally does not have the information that you have. And I think this idea is really important. And thinking through this, thinking through what our Mormon experiences teach us is really important. I think our Mormon experiences, because of their uniqueness and rarity, can help expand our theory of mind in some useful ways. Theory of mind's learned. It's not an inevitable thing that humans have, although the vast majority of human adults have a theory of mind, at least in the most basic sense, that they understand that other people don't literally see the world like you do. We differ in how nuanced our understanding of other people's minds are, but generally speaking, we understand that people don't literally see what we see. I think that we can reflect on our Mormon experiences and how they're different from many other people's experiences in ways that grant us more insight into how other people make sense of the world. Our beliefs are something that, I don't want to repeat myself too much. They are something that are unique, and especially once if we've experienced doubt or change or crisis, the experience of those things is also unique. And it can, it doesn't always, and it's not inevitable, but it can allow us to better understand how and why other people are thinking the way that they are, behaving the way that they are, how and why they're reacting the way that they are to the things that are happening to them. And I think that this, I don't know if I've done full justice to explaining what I mean by this, but I think this is one of the most important things that we've got going for us. We have a unique insight into human behaviors like doubting and changing fundamental worldviews and beliefs. Our exposure to other people in this Mormon community gives us insight into different ways of being Mormon, of doing Mormonism. And I think that if we're attentive to this, it can help us make a lot more sense of other people's behavior and in much more compassionate ways. Closely connected to this is, I think, some value that we can derive from our experiences is intellectual humility, that especially if you've experienced a faith crisis or serious doubt, that means that we know in a very deep and personal way what it means to admit that we're wrong about something big. And I think we misjudge how many other people understand what that's really like. I think there's a lot of discussion about, there's discussion out there about how people in the United States are becoming less religious and these sorts of things. But I think it's the case, anecdotally, and I think the data suggests that very large kind of faith transitions are relatively rare. And any sort of transition like that, any sort of doubt about something as core to our identities as our Mormon identities often are, that's a huge deal. Admitting that we're wrong about something that big, that important, that central to who we are, ought to cause us to have a lot of humility. It, for me at least, it tells me that I've been wrong about this big thing. What else might I be wrong about? What am I going to be wrong about again in the future? And for me, I think this lower certainty that what I'm doing is right, that I am this lower certainty that I am, that I've now figured it out, that I've got it, leads me to engage in more careful behavior. It leads me to think more carefully about the actions that I take, the judgments that I make about other people. And I think that it's something that our experiences as Mormons often, especially if we've had kind of a bumpy faith journey, that this we're predisposed to be better at this, I think. We don't always take this path of intellectual humility, but I think the potential is there, and I wish we would take advantage of it more often. Another part of this, related to the ostracism piece that I made before, is that we also know if we have gone through crisis or if we've doubted, we know how crappy it feels to be shamed for being wrong or for doubting, for questioning. And I think that ought to make us reluctant to do the same thing to others. We ought to be reluctant to shame other people for being wrong, for asking questions. We got to be reluctant to shame people for not changing fast enough, and those kinds of things. I think the experiences that I've had have really instilled in me a humility. And I mean, this is the literally a humble brag, I guess, I'm doing right now. But it has instilled in me an increase in humility and decrease in certainty. And I think it helps me be more cautious and careful when engaging with others and making judgments about others. Another value that I think often goes overlooked is the way that our Mormon experiences often, not always, often give us access to uniquely diverse social networks. I mean, I think few people would disagree with this statement. Our Mormon experiences connect us to people. And this is true in a unique way, even if you are only connected to other Mormons. So for example, again, this is where maybe growing up in certain parts of Utah, it might be harder to see the diversity in your Mormon social network, but I think it's there. I think it's still there. So our Mormon experiences connect us to people of different backgrounds. Our Mormon congregations, again, it might be different in certain parts of Utah and other heavily Mormon areas, but our Mormon backgrounds connect us across socioeconomic divides, across other aspects of background, across backgrounds of ethnicity. For me, this was the case. I went to church with a lot of people that I wouldn't have hung out with, that I couldn't hang out with for financial reasons and other stuff like that. But our beliefs connect us across these differences in backgrounds. And again, I think we often do a poor job of recognizing that. For many of us, again, not all of us, many of us, our missions are really important moments where we immerse ourselves among other people who are different than us in different places, and we connect with people. Service opportunities. I'm one of the first to criticize Mormons for often being way too quick to help other Mormons and not quick enough to help non-Mormons. But regardless, service is a major focus. Service is something that Mormons give, and it means interacting with other people. I've, in a lot of the volunteer work that I've done at like food banks and stuff, I will often see Mormons at those food banks volunteering. Some of the most valuable experience that I had on my mission was volunteering at a food bank in LA. It connected me to people that I wasn't otherwise going to be connected with. A worldwide community of Mormons. And I know that there's a lot more that goes into this. Not every community of Mormons is going to be equally welcoming to other Mormons and all that kind of stuff. But that potential that's there is so remarkable. I still think fondly about an experience I had with my dad when we were traveling in South America when I was in high school. We had a late bus ride. We got there too late. We got to our destination too late to find a hotel. And we ended up striking up a conversation with a kid on the street who knew where the local Mormon bishop lived. We went there. My dad showed his temple recommend to the local Mormon bishop in some border town in Brazil. And we ended up spending the night at this guy's place. And that is just remarkable to me. That community of Mormons that exist. Again, given my current relationship to Mormonism, I wouldn't be able to benefit quite the same way from that. But regardless, that network has so much potential that I think goes unrecognized. Sunstone is a huge thing for me. I wouldn't have known about it while I was a active kind of mainstream Mormon, but the Sunstone has been so amazing to me for its ability to connect me with people across the Mormon spectrum, people who have similar experiences to me, people who have very different experiences to me, and I've been able to learn so much from them. Ex-Mormon social media, for me personally, was a huge source of social support, continues to be a place that I go to learn from others, to just feel a sense of camaraderie, even though I rarely participate, to just be around people who are like me. These are not only are we as humans kind of generally motivated to connect, but I think our Mormon backgrounds make us very eager to connect in very deep ways. And I love the ways that I have learned to do this. So our Mormon experiences connect us. And I think I've already explained some of the benefits that I think come from this, but I want to elaborate a little bit more. This connection is a unique gift of community and belonging. Even if you've lost the sense of community and belonging that you had in the past, like I did, I don't have the same sense of community and belonging I have with the kind of the mainstream LDS church. I know what's possible, and I am so eager to create that with other people in ways that I think are more productive and more conducive with my values and that kind of stuff. I've been given that gift, and I want to give it to other people. I want to recreate that thing. It's given us the gift of interpersonal skill. And I know a lot of us probably don't think about it in this way, but the Mormon experience is a very participatory experience. It's something that often compels people who wouldn't otherwise be prone to interact with people or give talks or knock on doors or whatever, the opportunity to do this and support for doing so. It gives us intercultural knowledge, the exposure to people from different backgrounds, whether it's people from different backgrounds in our own city, in our own congregation, or people from different backgrounds on our mission or whatever else. It gives us intercultural knowledge that people don't often get. It's very common for people to just be in the same place their whole lives, to not branch out very much. And I think that we underestimate the value of this intercultural knowledge that's available, that's at our fingertips. It literally changes the way that we think about the world and the people in the world. And I say this as a psychologist, as a social psychologist, there's lots of research that shows that our contact with other people, our exposure to difference and diversity, changes the way that we organize information in our brains in ways that can, it doesn't always succeed, but it can make us less prejudiced, less likely to discriminate, less likely to rely on narrow stereotypes when judging other people. It can help us interact more effectively in a very diverse world where there's just a lot of different people with a lot of different mindsets and theories and kind of minds out there in the world. And in a very practical sense, it can help us make better informed decisions. Research on group behavior shows that the more exposure we have to different ideas, different viewpoints, different experiences, the less likely we are to make kind of narrow-minded decisions that aren't considering alternatives, that aren't considering the flaws in our views and that kind of stuff. And so we can really do a lot more to capitalize on our diverse social networks to make better decisions, to make sure that we're identifying the flaws in the way that we think and kind of maximizing the likelihood of good outcomes and helping us become better problem solvers as members of groups. Something that I'm very personally passionate about that, again, I think is that my Mormon experience has made me care about and be good at, that I think often goes overlooked, is the potential to help reduce ideological polarization and prejudice. So these are just a couple of graphics that illustrate the a couple of ways in which we are very polarized these days. We are politically polarized, ideologically polarized, religiously polarized, online, in person, around the world. We physically segregate ourselves into communities of like-minded people. On the internet, we segregate ourselves into like-minded communities of people. And I think that's a huge problem. And I'm happy to talk about that at length elsewhere, but it's a huge problem. And I think that our Mormon experiences actually put us in a uniquely good position to help combat this kind of process. We can use our experiences, use this diverse social network, use this intercultural, interpersonal knowledge that we have to help connect people who otherwise might not connect. We have access to hard to reach people in our lives. My social network, as a result of being an ex-Mormon and in the age of social media, means that I have a ton of friends on Facebook and social media from my Mormon days and a ton from my current kind of academic days. And it is full of highly conservative people, middle of the road people, Canadians, Americans, highly progressive academic types. It is full of all these people who would have little reason to interact with each other otherwise. And on the walls of my Facebook page, these people have interactions. I interact with them, and it is remarkable. And it is something that's overlooked as a benefit. I also think that in my work with kind of activist groups and civil discourse groups and that kind of stuff, one of their biggest challenges is figuring out how to reach the people who would most benefit from their messages. How do you, as a representative of a group, reach somebody who's predisposed to be suspicious of you and resistant to your message, right? And so I think that the way that so many of us in the Mormon world can and do straddle multiple perspectives of issues and have this intimate connection with people who think very differently, that I think that's a unique ability, unique resource that we have. On a more personal level, we can be the reason that people in our lives are forced to think twice about dismissing an entire group of people. I don't want to like overstate how big a difference it's made, right? But I know for me that my dad, he was a big reason. I'm gonna sneeze. I'm sorry. Part of the reason I had a faith crisis was because my dad came out as gay around the time of Proposition 8, and he was a reason that I had to think twice about my attitudes and beliefs about gay people. And I thought to think about that a lot. And I think that in that way, I can be a reason that other people have to think twice about people who doubt, about people who leave. I can be that person. And I think that that's a really important, often overlooked piece of value. We can also be the reason that someone does not adopt more extreme views than they currently have, which is part of the problem of polarization, is that people continue to separate themselves and segregate themselves. And within those groups, they continue to get more and more extreme and further apart. And I think that our access to these diverse social networks, our access to people on many sides of the Mormon experience, which is often highly correlated with political and other ideological views, that we can be a reason that somebody doesn't adopt more extreme views than they currently have. We can help slow that polarization or stop that polarization. We don't have to like switch somebody to our side to make a difference. We can just help people not become more extreme. And I think that's a really valuable thing. So in sum, our Mormon experience is unique. That unique experience can translate into a better understanding of other people. And that better understanding of others and of ourselves can be a source of gratitude and a way to help understand and manage our grief in more productive ways. But I also want to mention that none of these benefits are inevitable. It takes effort for this to happen. Even though I've mentioned this stuff to you, these attribution biases, these social identity processes are still functioning. It's still making us prone to exaggerate the bad in others, exaggerate the good in ourselves, to not be as intellectually humble as we ought to be. But the potential is there. And I think too few people even see that potential. Even if it's hard to realize that potential, too few people even see that potential. So I hope that me bringing it up is helpful in some way. And I want to finish with this quote from one of my favorite quotes from a cultural anthropologist, Clifford Geertz. One of the most significant facts about us may finally be that we all begin with the natural equipment to live 1,000 kinds of life, but end in the end having lived only one. And our Mormon experiences, as diverse as they are part of who we are. Even the grief-causing parts. And I think about this a lot. Even the parts of my Mormon experience that have made me cry repeatedly, that make me feel regret and resentment, they are part of who I am. I would not be able to kind of share these thoughts with you today if I didn't have those experiences. And I am grateful for that. I didn't necessarily always feel that way about it, but I am grateful that I have had the experiences that I've had, that I have gotten what I've gotten from my Mormon experience, so that I can engage with and connect with people in a way that I think is, that shows an appreciation of our shared humanity and the truly social nature of being human. And with that, I'll finish. Thank you very, very much for hearing me and sticking around for this.
Well, thank you very much. We will now open the floor for a few questions. So I will read those and you can ask them, or you can answer them, excuse me. So the first question is, will you be sharing your PowerPoint to the conference attendees?
I certainly can.
Okay. Would you like them to send you a message for that, or do you have a list?
Okay. Is it possible for me to like share it as an attachment to, on my session link or something like that?
It might be. I don't know that the answer to that question, though. I think they were able to do that last year, so I'm assuming we can. We'll find out how to do that and maybe follow up with that.
Sounds good. All right.
The next question. It sounds as if you are approaching this from a CBT-based framework. Would you care to elaborate on the perspective that you are speaking from? And then someone asked to define CBT.
Yes. So CBT is cognitive behavioral therapy. I'm not taking a specifically CBT perspective. It's a kind of a, like I said, not a therapist. But I've been told by my therapist friends and my partner, who's a clinical psychologist, that the way I talk about things sounds a lot like CBT. So it's not a particular therapeutic perspective. It's my take on what I think are some important fundamentals from social psych research that are useful for exercises in perspective taking.
All right, thank you. The next question is, how do you feel about journaling through grief to find the positive things around us?
I think it can be a really good thing. I've often been pretty terrible at journaling, even though it was something that was encouraged of me a lot. The times when I have journaled pretty consistently were times when I was feeling a lot of grief and a lot of strong emotions. And so I think that can be very, very useful. It's certainly you can try it on your own. It's also something that a lot of therapists would recommend, and that therapists could give you really good instructions for how to do it in a way that works, that's tailored to your experiences.
All right. Thank you. Next question. How unique is the Mormon connection? Do other unique groups quickly invite and connect with same group newcomers?
So I'm personally a little less familiar with how common that is among other religious groups, but I do know that Mormons tend to be among the more cohesive groups and among the more welcoming to other Mormons who aren't necessarily part of their community. And I think it's pretty unique that that just that Mormon affiliation is enough to build pretty serious trust without knowing very much about other people. But I do suspect that it's true for other very cohesive religious groups.
All right. And looks like we might have a duplicate here, so I'll just read one of these two. It says, what had to shift and soften so gratitude could come forward in your journey?
Part of it was that I did have to figure some things out. When I was in the midst of kind of grief, when I was kind of lost my community, lost my connection to friends, and some family members, it was hard for me to see the value in the experiences that I had had. So I think part of what helped me was forming connection with other people, finding a bit of a community elsewhere. But it also didn't, so I was in grad school at the time that I left the church, and I ended up kind of closely connecting with other grad students, my grad school cohort, and that became kind of my community. But then when I left grad school and started my first job across the country, I realized how little development I'd done in connecting with other people, that I felt very, very alone, and that I really, really missed that Mormon connection, the fact that I could have just, like in a new state, I could just go and connect with Mormons. I really, really missed that. So I'm kind of rambling a bit, but to try to answer your question, I think part of what had to change was I had to like take care of myself a little bit to make sure that my most fundamental needs were taken care of. And then I could kind of revisit my experiences in ways that I could see the gratitude more easily.
All right. And then another question that kind of follows that one is, how long did it take you to move from grief to the gratitude you feel now? I imagine the process can take years.
Yeah, I think it's going to differ for everybody, and it will depend a lot on your own personal experiences and the type of experience you had, the intensity of the experience. I don't think there's any correct length of time, just to be clear. And I still grieve a lot of things. Earlier this year, during General Conference weekend, I spent an hour on my porch kind of listening to Motab and crying, because I really missed the music. And that helped me realize that was a thing that I haven't found a way to deal with productively quite yet. But I guess the point is that the grief can take a long time, but I don't think the goal is necessarily to like eliminate it, and certainly not to forget about it. I think it's thinking about ways to kind of integrate it or look at it differently. But yeah, to your question, I think it's likely to take a long time, but I don't think that because it takes a long time means that you're necessarily going to be miserable the entire time. Just that, the grief will be there for a long time.
All right. We have time for one more quick question. I don't know how quick it'll be, but it says, is society better when like-minded people gather together or disperse into groups?
Oh man, that's a big question. Short answer is that within like-minded communities, well-being and cohesiveness and that kind of stuff is usually pretty high. But between like-minded communities, especially if those like-minded communities don't interact very much outside of their communities, it's likely to be really bad. So in general, I am a very ardent proponent of stepping outside of your groups and making sure, making deliberate choices so that you're not only around like-minded people. Like I said in the part about our diverse social networks is that making sure that we're around a diverse range of people and viewpoints will help us make better decisions. It'll help us be better able to solve problems across differences and so on and so forth. Yeah, there's a lot more that I could say, but I don't have time to say it. So
right.
Reach out.
Okay. So, well, I will with that, since you said there's a lot more, that question is still going to be out there on our Q&A section for your session here. And there's another question that was asked that we didn't have time to answer. Maybe you could take a moment sometime soon and answer those out there for all of us. I'd like to thank you all for attending and for Peter for presenting this amazing session. Our time is up. Enjoy the rest of your Sunstone.
Thank you so much, everybody.